Thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Bob Kinzel, co-host of Vermont Edition. Just wanted to let you know that this has been edited for brevity. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, it's been quite a week in Congress, and Vermont Representative Peter Welch has found himself right in the middle of a number of controversial issues. Welch sits on both the House Oversight Committee and the House Intelligence Committee. And this week, both committees heard from President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen. The proceedings for the Oversight Committee were conducted in an open session, while the Intelligence Committee hearing was behind closed doors and not available to the public. Congressman Welch had this interaction with Cohen at the Oversight Committee hearing on Wednesday afternoon.
Mr. Cohen, during your opening statement, which was at the height of the election, you testified you were actually meeting with Donald Trump in July 2016 when Roger Stone happened to call and tell Mr. Trump that he had just spoken to Julian Assange. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. And you said that Mr. Assange told Mr. Trump about an upcoming, quoting your opening statement, quote, massive dump of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. Wow. So I want to ask you about Roger Stone's phone call to the president. First of all, was that on speakerphone? Is that what you indicated?
Yes. So Mr. Trump has a black speakerphone that sits on his desk.
Right.
He uses it quite often because with all the number of phone calls he gets.
Right. Now, in January of this year, 2019, the New York Times asked President Trump if he ever spoke to Roger Stone about these stolen emails. And President Trump answered, and I quote, no, I didn't. I never did. Was that statement by President Trump true?
No, it's not accurate.
And can you please describe for us, to the best of your recollection, you were present, exactly what Mr. Stone said to Mr. Trump?
It was a short conversation, and he said, Mr. Trump, I just want to let you know that I just got off the phone with Julian Assange. And in a couple of days, there's going to be a massive dump of emails that's going to severely hurt the Clinton campaign.
On Wednesday at the House Oversight Committee, also this week, the House voted in favor of a gun safety bill that requires background checks for all gun sales. And the House also voted to disapprove of the president's decision to declare an emergency in order to transfer money from several programs, including housing for veterans, to efforts to build a wall along the Mexican border. And joining us now to discuss the events in Washington this week is Vermont Congressman Peter Welch. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be back, Bob.
Great to have you here. Let's start off today talking about the testimony from Michael Cohen, President Trump's former attorney. Did you find Mr. Cohen to be a credible witness?
Well, I did. I mean, the question is, can a liar, he's a convicted liar, ever tell the truth? And you approach it with skepticism, but the topics that he spoke about, he had corroboration for. For instance, the payoffs to Stormy Daniels. He had the canceled checks, one of which was signed by President Trump himself when he was in the White House. So there was corroboration in what Mr. Cohen said that made him credible to, I think, most of the members of the committee. But every American can make their own decision. The other point that was pretty clear is that the Republicans who were challenging him were not challenging him on anything that he said specifically. They were basically attacking him because he had been convicted, including of perjury. But they weren't going to the specifics of it. And then finally, if you notice, the other attack was that he was, quote, the Democratic witness. He was the Trump witness. We didn't pick Michael Cohen. President Trump did and chose him to be the person at his side as his personal attorney for 11 years. So obviously, because of that position, he had information that was relevant.
So what do you say to those listeners who are wondering, how could you possibly find him to be a credible witness when he's already been convicted of lying to Congress?
Well, I was listening to a former head of the Southern District and one of the Michael Kelly or David Kelly. And he was talking about how when the FBI has a witness who has a criminal background, they do it because that person has knowledge. And then because they have deep skepticism about that person's truthfulness, they have to corroborate things that he says. And that's what you saw with Michael Cohen when he came in and he was making statements about the Stormy Daniels payoffs. He had the canceled checks. So the corroboration, I think, is what's key.
On Wednesday, Mr. Cohen testified in public in front of members of the Oversight Committee. You're a member of that committee. On Thursday, he testified in a closed session with members of the House Intelligence Committee. You're also a member of that panel. I appreciate that it might be very difficult for you to discuss testimony that was taken in secret. I'm wondering if there are any general areas that you can discuss with us.
Well, I can describe how the hearing was different. I can't describe, obviously, the substance. And some of that was because we don't want to interfere with any of the ongoing investigations. And, of course, there's the Mueller investigation and there's the investigation in the Southern District of New York. But what I found to be helpful is that it's a smaller committee. There's only 23 members on it. And there was no press. And the benefit of that is that all of the focus of the members of the committee, both Republicans and Democrats, was on asking questions and not playing to the cameras, quite frankly. We had more time for questioning. And in fact, Mr. Cohen is going to be returning on March 6th. So I found to be the combination of both hearings, certainly for my benefit, was very, very helpful. And then the other thing that's good for the American people is that the plan is for us to release the transcripts of that testimony. I mean, ideally, anything related to this investigation should be made public. That would be my preference. And the chair of the committee, Mr. Schiff, has indicated that our goal is to have a full release of the transcripts of the testimony sooner rather than later.
Today in the program, our guest is Vermont Congressman Peter Welch. We're talking about his role on both the Oversight Committee and the Intelligence Committee this week, taking testimony from Michael Cohen, President Trump's former attorney. Lots of other issues down in Congress. If you've got a question or a comment for Congressman Welch, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. So, understanding that it's difficult for you to talk about what happened on Thursday, did you learn any additional information that raises concerns about the actions of President Trump?
Well, even on the oversight, the public hearing, there were concerns raised about the president's conduct. I mean, number one, the campaign violation is clearly a crime, in that was some the President Trump signed the check himself. So that's a concern. Second, I think an ongoing concern is Russia and what the whole Trump Tower Russia issue was. And we talked about that certainly in the open hearing. But one of the things that I found alarming as a citizen was Michael Cohen's testimony, for which he committed perjury, where he said that the discussions on Trump Tower ended in January of 2016, when in fact they were going on well into June of 2016 during the presidential campaign. And that's something that's disturbing to me as a citizen, because I think a person who's running for president that is having business dealings with one of our major adversaries, the American people are entitled to know that. And one of the things I found disturbing is Michael Cohen would say that he'd be with the president at a rally and the president would be saying, no Russian, no business, no nothing. And then on the walk to the car, he'd ask Mr. Cohen about how things are going in the Russian negotiation.
So did you learn anything this week that makes it more likely that you would support an effort to impeach the president?
I'm going to wait for the Mueller report. I mean, there's a number of things here that are of concern to me. I mean, you have a campaign violation. Is that impeachable? It's a crime. But is that something that goes to high crimes and misdemeanors? I don't think so. But there should be accountability for that. Then you have the misrepresentation by the president about ongoing efforts to get a business deal in Russia during the campaign, when he's telling the American people he's not involved in that at all. One of the other issues that's going to come up is the perjury that Mr. Cohen committed when he put January as opposed to June. I mean, it mystifies me why he would do that. But he was that was after consultation with a lawyer that was representing the president. So that's going to be a big question. What role, if any, did the president play in that or his lawyer play in that? So there's more to be done, and we're going to have more witnesses in, both in the oversight committee and also on the intelligence committee.
Now, you've got a bunch of Democrats in Washington. I think a lot of them are the newly elected group caucus of about 40 or 50 members who really seem to want to start the proceedings of impeachment against the president. What do you say to them?
Well, my goal is that we focus on getting concrete legislation done. I mean, all the focus in the press was understandably on the Cohen hearing. But last week, we did a couple of things that are really critical. I think, number one, we, for the first time in the House, passed significant gun safety legislation. You know, Vermont's way ahead of us. And that was a big decision for Vermont. But we passed legislation in the House by a pretty good vote to end the gun show loophole. Secondly, and this is really significant, we passed the resolution with 13 Republicans voting with us to repudiate the so-called emergency declaration. And that goes to the core of our constitutional system of checks and balances. I mean, what the president did in declaring an emergency and then using that to justify misappropriating money, taking money from military accounts for military construction that had been approved by the House of Representatives and the Senate, and then redirecting that to the wall, is a clear violation of the Constitution, in my view. And the big – that is what, in my regard, is a very big threat. We have to maintain our democratic system of checks and balances. So last week, that vote by the House to stand by Article 1 and the constitutional right of the Congress to appropriate money and to not let a president unilaterally overcome that, I think was very significant.
I guess what I'm wondering from your perspective, is there a danger for the Democrats in the House to be talking about impeachment, to be saying, let's start impeachment proceedings without the Mueller report?
Well, I do. I mean, I think that the Mueller report has, I think, the most credibility of any investigation that's occurring. I mean, you even saw in the oversight hearing. I mean, we should have had that. And I'm sorry that my Republican colleagues were not as interested in finding out what Mr. Cohen knew. But that's politics, and you expect that. But Mueller has been very scrupulous about doing the investigation without getting in the press, without politicizing it. And, of course, there's a lot that's come out of Mueller. I mean, he's in Paul Manafort, the campaign manager, is going to jail. The president's national security advisor pled guilty. Several other indictments. So there's a lot there, and it is being done by a person who is a Republican, Mr. Mueller, and who has the benefit of a career that has earned him the high regard of people on both sides of the aisle. So I want to let that happen. We've got to do our oversight, and last week was an example of what I said I wanted to do when I was running for re-election, and that is we do our oversight. But I really want to also focus on doing things that are important for the American people, like that gun safety legislation, like standing up for the separation of powers. And next week, we're going to be working on trying to bring down prescription drug prices. In fact, there's some potential for a bipartisan cooperation on that. Mick Mulvaney, the chief of staff, he and I were talking a lot about that when I was with him at Camp David, and he's going to be convening a breakfast of some of the leaders on this. And my hope is that we'll make some progress. So oversight, but also progress on important things for everyday Americans.
Let's go to our listeners and talk to Charlie, who's calling from Northfield. Hey, Charlie, welcome to the program.
Thanks. A quick question. I'd like to know if Cohen is immune from perjury, and if he's not, and he lies, if he perjures himself, is he subject to criminal charges?
The answer to that is yes. So if he lied to Congress, either in the Intelligence Committee or in the Oversight Committee, he could be charged for that new lie.
Charlie, thanks for your phone call. I just had one question on the Mueller report. Tell me if I've got this process correctly. Mueller is going to issue a report. The report is going to be delivered to the Attorney General's office. It will then be up to the Attorney General's office to decide how much, if any, of that report should be made public. Is that right?
That's correct. And there's a lot of apprehension about what decision the new Attorney General would make. But I think it would be absolutely outrageous to deny access to the American people of what is in that report. If there are some secret issue matters or sources and methods, things that normally are not disclosed, those could be redacted. But it would be really appalling to me as a citizen, let alone as Vermont's member of Congress, that we would not see the results of that investigation by Mr. Mueller.
What recourse do you have?
We could subpoena it. There'd be hearings, but right away there would be a subpoenas issued to get that, and there would probably be a court challenge. So that would be really regrettable. I mean, this report is going to be the gold standard of what it is we know. We don't know what's going to be in it. We don't know. But not even seeing it means that everybody's going to have their own opinion. And that would be, I think, a shattering blow to people's confidence that they're getting a report. They're getting the news on the level.
Let's talk to Marilyn, who is calling from Franklin. Hi, Marilyn. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Representative Welch. I'm calling to ask a question that contains something of a comment in it concerning the. Border checks. In Franklin, I live about a mile from the Canadian border, and as I understand it, you have tried to negotiate these random border patrol checks that can take place within 100 miles of an international border in the United States, down to 25 miles, within 25 miles. And my question is basically why those of citizens of us who live within 25 miles of the border are liable to lose our privacy and due process rights, along with those other American citizens who live within 100 miles of the border throughout the country.
Well,
I mean, this could mean hundreds of thousands of miles that where we would be subjected to losing constitutional rights.
Well, thank you for that. The Border Patrol has the responsibility to try to keep our borders secure. And they have been given some enforcement authority that is now getting expanded, I think, well beyond what's, quote, reasonable, to go from 25 miles to 100 miles into Vermont, into our entire country from any border or waterway. In Vermont, that would essentially mean like 90%. I may have that wrong, but 90% of the state would always be subject to these random searches and seizures. I think that there's a more reasonable expectation on the part of all of us that if we're right within the zone of the border, whether it's 25 miles or 24 miles, that's one thing. But to have it be 100 miles where literally the vast majority of the state at any time for almost any reason could be stopped for so-called border security, that is an overreach. And that's why Senator Leahy, Senator Sanders, and I are trying to restrict it but not stop it altogether out of some respect for the necessity to do some border security work.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Congressman Peter Welch. You had a meeting earlier this week with a group of mayors in Vermont to talk about infrastructure, road repair, bridge repair. And as you look at this infrastructure bill in Washington, there's also been a lot of talk about broadband infrastructure. Are all these issues kind of lumped together in a big infrastructure bill, or would you be dealing with them separately?
No, they would be largely lumped together. One of the big concerns that the mayors have was the water and stormwater and systems. And water treatment systems that are ancient in many of our communities. In fact, I think in Rutland they have some pipes that go back to the Civil War. So that's been a focus by the mayors. They also really talked about transit. as well as the roads and bridges. But the broadband is an issue, interestingly enough, that is incredibly important to our more rural communities. And we've got to have that be a part, a major part of any infrastructure bill. And we have a rural broadband caucus because this is an area where there's some unity between Republicans and Democrats. Any of us who represent folks in rural America know that absent broadband, we're just going to have a further decline in the strength of rural America. And we are insisting, and again, this is bipartisan, that in this infrastructure bill, we make a commitment similar to what this country made in the 1930s with the Rural Electrification Administration. We made a decision then that even though it wasn't economically advantageous, quote, for the investors to electrify America, it was important to rural America and it was a social policy decision. And that is incredibly important with broadband because if we're going to get jobs in our rural communities, entrepreneurs have to have access to high-speed broadband. And so there's a group of us that are going to really be fighting extremely hard to make certain that there is a good broadband component.
As you mentioned, it's a bipartisan bill in many ways. People have been talking about this bill, it seems like, for the last year or so. President Trump has indicated a willingness to support this bill. What's the outlook for it now? Is anything going to happen?
I think it is. In the House, the chair of the committee has as a goal of trying to bring a bill out by May or so. That may be a little bit flexible, but he's totally committed to it. The leadership is committed to it. And in the past, when it was the Republican majority, the head of the then Transportation Committee and Infrastructure Committee also was. So it's there. Now, what's different this year and last year that gives me more hope is the very difficult challenge of how are you going to fund it is really what deadlocked the transportation bills before. People were willing to spend the money but not willing to pay for it. And I remember we were doing three-month extensions of the transportation bill, which was absurd. And I stopped voting for them because you can't even plan a bridge, let alone build a bridge in 3 months. And I told then-Speaker Boehner, look, I'll support any revenue measure that you can put together so that we get 218 votes to get this bill done. And I think there may be more willingness to come up with a way to pay for it that's acceptable.
What might that be?
Well, it could be – I would think user fees. And the gas tax is probably what you're asking about, but that hasn't been raised at the federal level since 92 or 94. You know, the bottom line here, let's get real. Potholes don't fix themselves. And we've got to pay for the things that we do. And my experience has been both at the state level particularly, is that when people have confidence that – it's going into a trust. The money's going into a trust fund, and then it's spent for the designated purpose. And they have confidence that it's not being wasted. Tough as it is, they're much more willing to support it. And I think we just have to have this infrastructure bill, Bob. We've got to have better roads, better bridges, better water systems, and better broadband. And it doesn't come free. And now, ideally, we do it together because then there'd be political support on both sides, even in people would have some confidence, I think, with a bipartisan bill that we probably got it more right than wrong.
Let's talk to David, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for taking my call. Hi, Representative Welch.
Hi.
I have a question. After I watched 60 Minutes for the first time in about 20 years last Sunday. And they had Kessler, the former FDA director, and a couple other people on, including the head of the pharmaceutical company. And they were talking about the FDA and the pharmaceutical representatives in 2001 behind closed doors changing the instructions for use of opioids so that people could use it several times a day and over long term, prescribe it over long term for chronic pain, despite the fact that there's no science that says that that's an appropriate use. And in fact, all the science indicates that if you take opioids over a long period of time, as you well know, you become addicted, you have to take a larger dose, and gradually your health is going to decline and you're probably going to die, which is not really something that the FDA or the government should be promoting. So I'm curious, why hasn't the Congress made FDA rescind that that change. That would stop. It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would stop the ongoing growth and more people getting addicted. And it seems like a really simple thing to me to for the Congress to just recognize that and change it.
Well, two things. Number one, I think that has been changed. But number two, the point you make really is identifying one of the biggest scandals that we've had since the tobacco scandal, where the tobacco companies and their executives were claiming that there was no link between tobacco and cancer when they knew there was a direct link between tobacco and cancer. And right now, what's happening with respect to that what you just discussed is there's litigation, much like there was tobacco litigation. I mean, the Purdue Pharma, which produced OxyContin and was owned by the Sackler family, there's board minutes out there that they wanted to find ways to get doctors to prescribe more and more and more. And now to the extent that the FDA went along with that is outrageous in retrospect, obviously. And it's so bad, I think I may have this a little bit wrong, but the point is correct. We've got like in this country 5% of the population of the world, but we have 80% of the opioids. I mean, overprescription was a brutal, wicked problem. And once a person gets it's very easy to get addicted apparently because of what happens to your brain chemistry. So you've got a good point. And there is, I can say now, I think a much greater awareness within the FDA, certainly within Congress. And the opioid addiction issue has really knows no boundaries, Republican or Democrat. So it's one area where we're starting finally to address it.
So as far as you know, the FDA has rescinded its long-term approval for the use of opioids?
I think those have changed. I'm going to go back and check on this. But I know even in the legislation we passed, we're trying to have doctors do something that Vermont started having them do, and that is cut down on those prescriptions. And I know the medical community is now much more aware of the hazards of this. Now, it used to be, this is one of the things you might be talking about, that one of the indicators by which a hospital was judged is did the patient leave saying they were, quote, pain-free? And that was something that was promoted by the opioid industry. Well, you could be leaving pain-free but about to become an addict. So that's been changed. But it's really, really terrible that when you look back and you kind of wonder how in the world did that policy ever get going.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Ellen in Marshfield. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just have a question going back about earlier conversations. The Justice Department policy, we're told, is that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And my question is sort of a who, what, when, where, how. Who determines that? How is that decided? It's not in the law or regulations. It's not in the Constitution. Does somebody in the Justice Department just decide that this is a policy we'll have? And then my follow-up to that is there anything that can be done about it to change that? Thanks.
Well, you know, you're asking a question I kind of scratch my head about because it doesn't seem right. And I think here's what I think is the issues here. Number one, since it's a policy, the policy could be changed. It's not an act of Congress. It's not a law. And let's say President Trump, you remember that famous boast he made, the only way I'd lose is if I wouldn't lose my voters if I shot somebody on Fifth Avenue. Well, you know, if a president did something like that, I bet they'd be indicted. You'd have the Justice Department saying, yeah, that's been our policy, but this really requires us to change it. On the other hand, if there's an infraction that that could await the expiration of the president's term and then he or she would be held to account. You may not want to disrupt the country by having the president have to deal with a much lesser situation. So I think that's the key here. It's a policy. That doesn't mean it's a law, and it could be changed depending on what the circumstances were.
We got this email from Doug in Fairfax, who wants to know about your policies and your thoughts about the U.S. coup in Venezuela Doug wants to know, why are you not speaking out about the impending coup? The current government, whatever its faults, was democratically elected. The opposition and self-declared government backed by the United States is largely made up of elites who will turn over the resources of Venezuela to U.S. corporations.
Well, very serious situation in Venezuela. And number one, let me say at the outset, I totally oppose the use of American force. We shouldn't even be threatening it. We have a sordid history of interfering in elections in Central and South America. So no U.S. force. Number two, I do not agree with him that that was a democratically elected government. I think Maduro's a bad guy, and I think that was a rigged election. All of the evidence that we have is that it was a totally bogus election. And under the current constitution of Venezuela, when there's not been a valid election, the Speaker of the House, that's Mr. Guaido, becomes the acting president. So that's the debate there. This is something that is happening under Venezuelan law, not by outside forces. Outside forces, like our government and other governments, have recognized that the proper leader under the Venezuelan constitution is the Speaker of the House, Mr. Guaido. And by the way, once he gets inaugurated, he became president under the Venezuelan constitution. They have to have an election within 30 days so the Venezuelan people are allowed to make the decision about who leads them. So that's the situation in Venezuela as I understand it. But I do not want the United States to get militarily involved. I want the people of Venezuela to be making the decision about who leads them.
Earlier, we were talking about this infrastructure package, and you're saying that perhaps raising the federal gas tax might be a good idea or an acceptable idea. You know, we've got a lot more electric cars on the road these days. How are you going to bring people who travel in electric vehicles into the mix and have them sharing some of this financial responsibility?
Well, number one, they have to be part of it. If a gas tax is a user fee, and if somebody is using a vehicle that doesn't pay gas taxes, but they get the benefit of the road network, they have to pay. So one of the proposals is miles charged. Something might be a fee at the time of purchase. We'd have to work that out. But the bottom line here is that if you are going to fund your transportation system with a user fee, then the people who use it should be the ones who help pay, regardless of whether they drive a gas-powered vehicle or an electric-powered vehicle.
Do you have any privacy concerns with the idea of saying to folks, how many miles did you drive, where did you drive, having some sort of gizmo in your car that would tell them that?
Well, I don't have a problem with telling, knowing how many miles somebody drived. I certainly object to know where and when and how they got there. But, you know, one of the proposals I heard that I thought made some sense, actually, Margaret, my wife, proposed this, is that when you go for your vehicle inspection, you have your mileage. You always give it already right now, and then you can compare it to what your mileage was when you were last in, and then that would be the number of miles that you'd be assessed. Now, the challenge with that is that's a big check for people to write because, you know, most of us are used to paying this each time we get a gallon of gas and we pay the gas tax. So that's the practical issue, but that would address, I think, the privacy concern.
We're going to be following many of these issues in the weeks and months ahead. Congressman Peter Welch, many thanks for taking the time to be on the program today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.